Well, here we are. I get to talk to one of my friends today, one of my friends for a long time. And I use that word so loosely, but I don't. I just know a lot of people. I guess if you're around long enough and you kiss enough ass and try to get people to like you because you had no friends as a kid, you stay friends with people. And I love this man. It's Paul Reiser today on the episode on the podcast. And you know what to do when you get this thing. You subscribe and you rate and review and all those things. You say nice stuff. And then I'll call you guys once in a while. There's a phone number up there. You can leave a message and I'll tell you when I'm going to do that on the Twitter or on the Instagram stories. But more importantly, I'm getting right to the show because this is a guy that I've always kind of looked up to because he's 3 months older than I am. And I've known him forever. And we're going to talk about it because Paul Reiser is coming on the show. So, ladies and gentlemen and children, he doesn't curse. So I don't think you're going to have a problem. He has been eaten by aliens in the movie Aliens. He, of course, well, I'm not going to say his credits because we'll talk about it. You know him from everything. Mad About You. Why do his credits? My Two Dads. I mean, his show could have lasted forever. And I ended up being My Three Dads. So we're going to be discussing that. Okay, here is Paul Reiser. So, Paul, we've been seeing each other. Are you in a dungeon somewhere?
I am in the bottom of a Russian embassy where I have been kept because I have some very interesting secrets. I am not messy. You look like a guy who does this all the time. I can make it a little brighter. I'm a little...
yeah. I like it. You look adorable.
It's moody. You know what I mean? People see it, I go, ooh. It's like putting on a Johnny Mathis album.
Well, I always get moody during Johnny Mathis.
Yeah, you see, Reiser's Johnny Mathis. Let me come up with a less than 70-year-old reference.
Yeah, no one, the kids today, you could say, you can't even say Pharrell. That's no, old school. John Legend is always good. John Legend will never.
There you go.
Right.
I'll sit back. That's a little better, maybe.
Yeah, then I'll do that too. We can both sit back.
But what is it? I'm very busy, Bob. Why do you call me at home like this when we have so many things to do?
But Paul, we arranged. I thought we, but we, but I. We
oh, that's
said,
true. Yes, we did. You know what's interesting?
And we had a lunch that we don't talk about.
But you and I know each other for going on 40 years, and yet I would say in the last few months we've spent more time than ever.
And together. Isn't it? I think it's one of the things I like about quarantine. I've been able to connect with a couple people, and seeing you has been something I always would say. Hey, let's go to dinner, you know, with Paula, and then.
And
finally,
it never
It never happens. But now I've got a permanent wife. She can't leave. I have information on her.
And you're locked in the house, and I'm locked in a basement.
You're nice. I would just say change the curtains. It looks like my dad's old shorts.
I didn't think you'd notice it. But you know, I could let that light in.
But no, that'll backlight you. No,
I'll do that, so you don't have to see your dad.
But
shorts.
Can't you just make them like blue? Look at them.
Realize that talking to you would cost me in interior decorating and in just wear and tear on my soul.
Amazon at $6 to fix that Drake problem. I mean, I've got Rodney Dangerfield and Red Fox right there. You've got the drapes from my dad's pantaloons. Yeah, I've got Rodney. Actually, in solid form in a jar. I do have his pot pipe here. He gave me his pot pipe, and I don't smoke pot. But Rodney's widow gave me his pot pipe.
That's very special.
It's loving.
Your mom gave me your dad's shorts. So
I thought you were going to say her virginity, which is not possible.
I was working backwards.
Oh, she never did that.
How long have you had this podcast?
This is the 60-somethingth episode. So it's been, I started doing it in studio, and then I was going to go on tour and go do Canada dates. And then I had to cancel the dates. And then they said, you can't come into the studio. So they brought me the podcast board, and then I do it from home, and I love it. I planned to do it just because I was out doing stand up and people really were upset about a lot of things, and I wanted to do this. It wasn't like, hey, I'm not working on a TV show.
I love
show.
That even though you have a full studio thing, you hold the mic as if you're on stage. They have little stands that you that can eliminate that problem.
I don't like the stand because then I'm just here doing this, and I watch people do it with the stand. I like holding it. I don't know.
I like when it comes down like a 1940s boxing fight.
Right. You want it to be like...
Yeah, then it's very studio. Right.
I'm sorry. Mike's in the shot. I'm really sorry. It's a story of my directing career. I've never done any directing where there wasn't a mic in the shot. I purposely have it there.
There were great John Cassavetes movies where not just the boom, but literally the guy holding the boom is in the shot. And you go, nobody saw that? Nobody saw a guy named Phil holding...
And today they would have taken that out with CGI, but they couldn't. They couldn't not use it because his movies were done so impromptu and so amazing.
Yeah,
that's a reference that kids should definitely. Anything that John Cassavetes made.
I watched a couple of weeks ago with my 20-year-old son, who's pretty film hip. We watched Charlie Kaufman's new movie, which referenced A Woman Under the Influence. And I said, you've never seen A Woman on Netflix. You should see it. So we watch it. It's almost 3 hours, which I didn't realize going in. But he made it through all of it. And it's an incredible movie. Really long.
I didn't know it was 3 hours.
Almost 3 hours, like 2:40. But it's almost structureless. But the performances of Peter Falk and Jenna Rollins are so riveting.
And she won the Academy Award for that.
He, I think, was nominated and should have won. But John Cassavetes was the original indie film guy.
And yet his movie, and then he was the bad guy in movies like The Fury, Rosemary's Baby, Columbo.
I remember that. He was the conductor, right?
The Fury, yeah.
Yeah. And then his son, Nick Cassavetes, is a very accomplished director.
Oh, he's so talented.
Of this has anything to do with There's Johnny.
No, but that's fine because but I want to catch up with you too because we're going to talk about your show.
Yeah, I got nowhere to be except for maybe a lighting store.
I would say the pants in the window. I mean, it's a signal to people that the Russians are coming. That's what you've got going. You've got them. You're literally doing, which brings up the Kaminsky method, which is Alan Arkin, who is no longer with the show, and yet you are now filming that show, correct?
I am filming that show. Not that I am taking Alan's place, because nobody could. But yes, we just started. I did this is my first week on Kaminsky. It's going to be the final season. This will be the third and final. They're only going to do 6 episodes. And Chuck Lorre has brilliantly wrapped it up and wrote really beautiful scripts. And I'm excited to do it.
It's a very special show. And you're such a good actor. I was telling you this at lunch the other day, and I believe food was coming out of your mouth uncontrollably.
But I couldn't really hear. So what were you saying?
It's hard when we chew to be able to hear at a certain point.
Exactly.
You've always been a great actor. I always looked up to you. I mean, we met. You're 3 months older than me.
That's right. And I never let you forget it.
No, you don't. You don't. And I forget it. And so you do remind me. But we met in New York at the clubs. And then you came down and visited me when I was in Florida opening for Rupert Holmes at the Diplomat.
And I was at the Comic Strip, which was the original sort of Animal House gig. Because 5 idiot comics would be in this shithole of a house that they rented. And the comics, and they said, and you were playing, with Rupert, and we went down. So I was so impressed because we were playing this, really. It's amazing. They built a brand new club in the Comic Strip in Florida, but like they put in old carpeting. So like even upon its opening, it was like, it feels old. The whole place feels old. But you were on this beautiful stage with lights and an orchestra.
Bombing. I was bombing.
Didn't do well, but still. I was impressed. Not a laugh for 20 minutes, but you know what? Just the sheer balls that you would stay up there.
Yeah, I did my whole 25 minutes or something. And then Rupert Holmes, it was quiet for him. And then he sang Pina Colada song and a few of the people moved. I had a guy named Sam Friedland own the place, and he owned the company my dad worked for, Food Fair Pantry Pride Supermarkets.
Really?
And he was in the front row. And he was an old man. And I'm on stage and I said, I wanted to be a doctor when I grew up. And then as I got older, and he heckled me and said, you should have become one.
Nice.
So I went, wow, that's the owner.
Wow.
So that was not good. But you came there and you, I was so happy to see you guys.
It was not, yes. It's always a mixed thing. You want your friends to do, you know, do well. You want a friend, you want to do well when your friends are there. That's, you know, that classic joke of a guy says, oh, yeah, I killed last night. What did I kill? Really? What show did he goes, oh, really? Yeah, I ruined the joke. Oh, you should have seen me last night. Frank goes, I was there. Yeah, the band fucked me up.
Yeah. I heard it. The manager, it came to the comic, and the comic had two shows. Did you see the first, the second show? It came to the second. But it doesn't really matter. Yours is right. You only need one show that the guy came to.
No, you need two, but you need to tell the joke better than I just did.
No, but you're acting. You know, when you got a job, you don't have to hit the punchlines.
You know what? Sadly, not true. But who else did you open for in your opening days?
I opened for Kenny Loggins.
Wow. Where?
And I toured with Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons.
Wow.
And I was with Frankie Valli in Pittsburgh the night that he found out his daughter passed away from a drug overdose. And that's what Jersey Boys is based on.
Not the fact that you were there.
They didn't include me in the show. They didn't have a hack comic with a guitar on. You know, and we have bad news. Yeah, I saw the opening act, but Bobby wrote the play and Frankie.
What year would that have been? Early 80s?
Yeah. I mean, I moved out to LA in 78, and then I signed with my managers when I was 22. I was on a Comedy Store college tour that Mitzi put me on, and I signed with two guys from Buffalo, and they were Brad Gray and Harvey Weinstein. And I was with them for a little bit, and then they split up.
I didn't know that they were actually ever a team.
They weren't really for long. It was Harvey was a rock promoter, never touched me, and then because he did it from 3 feet away. But this then, is I've been. Go ahead, sorry.
No, I had nothing. I'm just trying to picture a town that had Harvey Weinstein and Brad Gray.
Buffalo, New York, and Brad was a student at University of Buffalo, I believe. And then I signed with him. He was my first manager.
Wow.
And Brad and Harvey split, and the rest is a bunch of stuff. But anyway, I have a question I've always wanted to ask you, because I went to acting school. I studied in L.A. with Daryl Hickman. Jerry Seinfeld recommended, why don't you go to this guy? He went to Milton Casales for a while and then other places to learn to act. He didn't love acting. It wasn't something he talks about it. So you had an inherent ability to be a good actor. Did you study?
Well, here's a funny thing. So I did study. Well, so here's the crazy thing. So I was in a class when I was out in LA in the middle 80s, early 80s, I studied with Larry Moss for a couple of years. And it was great fun. And it was always funny that everybody loved the class so much that if anybody got a job, they would actually go, now I have to miss class Tuesday. It's like, no, asshole, you're supposed to get a job. That's the
right
reason. But that's why in the Kominsky method, those acting class scenes ring so familiar to me because it really feels authentic. But in New York, I studied with a guy that Larry Moss studied with, a guy named Peter. His name will come to me.
I remember it was Peter.
Peter Flood.
Oh.
And then Ronnie Orbach taught a class. Do you remember Ron Orbach? Ron Orbach was the brother of Judy, who was a singer at the Improv, and he was an actor, and he taught this great class. Anyway, so I was taking this class. Come February 81. Yeah, February 81. I auditioned by accident, but I ended up auditioning for Diner.
Right.
I couldn't wait to show off how brilliant all the stuff that I had learned in acting class. And the irony was my act at that time was like 20 minutes of jokes about diners. I would talk about guys having coffee and the Greek guys and the cakes that go around on America. It was all diner stuff.
I remember.
And I said, well, I want to show off that I'm not a comedian, but I'm rather a thespian. And I read with Barry Levinson, the director, and he said, don't act. Just, you know what? It's really just five guys sitting around having coffee. I'm like, that's what I was trying to not do. He goes, no, but that's what I want. I went, what are the chances that I found a movie where the guy wants diner acting? And so I had kind of threw out everything that I thought I knew. I didn't know that much, but you know, he was very good at bringing out the best of people.
And he's amazing, and you're amazing in that movie. I mean, you're gonna eat those fries became part of the vernacular.
Well, you know, that was all Barry hearing stuff that I was saying in real life. He goes, "Do the thing with the thing with the thing with the fries." I'm like, "No, I was just asking him for the fries." He goes, "Do it again."
Yeah, that's so the magic, and that's all anybody. That's a quote. You know, people talk about that to this day.
And he literally didn't know it. And then the next day, we were the scene where we're leaving the diner, and I went, "Everybody has their car," and I said, "Does my character have a car?" He goes, "No, you should ask somebody for a ride. Ask Gutenberg." I said, "What should I say?" He goes, "Just whatever." So I literally, because I had no place to go, I had to get a ride with Gutenberg. And at the end, and he said, "Yeah, that's great." I went, "I don't think that's anything." And then I saw the movie. I went, "Oh, look at what he did. He took the best pieces of both of those." And suddenly it looked like I had a character that like, oh, I'm the guy who can't ask for something. But it was really out of improvs. And I can't say that I actually knew where it was going or what I was doing, but luckily he did. And he made us look good.
But you also had an ease about you, which I always liked. It felt like, oh, I know that guy. Oh, I like that guy. That's why you played doctors. That's why you play therapists. You have a thing, you know?
But it's also, don't you find in stand-up that you find yourself, and it may not be your actual self, but whatever sweet spot, you know, I mean, your thing on stage is very much you off stage, right?
And it's changing more and more. And I think I'm becoming a more of a hybrid of who I am. And I was about to go do a tour where I was talking long stories about racism and things I was going through as a kid and more me, more actual like this kind of, except funny. But I wanted to tell you that I met with Barry. Barry saw me at the Comedy Store, and Barry's roots, of course, were in stand-up. He and Craig Nelson were a team.
Yeah.
And I went in and read for him. He didn't want a casting director. Yep. Wow. And guess what part? It's not a hard one to figure out.
Ellen Barkin?
Exactly. Totally.
Well, this the role for Modell for
was it Danny Stearns? Yeah,
but for Danny Stearns, because the role that I had wasn't really in the script. It was there was five guys, and I'm my cross to bears are like, I'm the guy not in the poster. If you ever see the poster, yeah, I'm not it. So I'm that guy. So, but the movie was five guys, and he had this idea that the sixth guy was going to be, you know, rounding off the group, and he'd be funny. So that's why he was coming to the comedy clubs, and he was looking for somebody. And I happened to, it was like 2 weeks before they started the movie, and I walked into the right place. But anyway, I was at the comic strip again in Florida. It might've even been the same trip for all I know. And I got a call from the producer, Mark Johnson, like, "You got it." I went, "Really? Okay. Can you be in Baltimore on the 12th? I went, he goes, "Do you have any other commitments?" And like in his mind, like, "Oh, I have a series." I said, "I have one gig in Jersey for $70. I can get out of it, pretty sure."
And I'm eating on Friday.
Yeah, I had nothing. I said, "But I have a gig in Bernardsville, New Jersey." So he said, "Do you have an agent?" And I said, "No, I don't have any. I know. Why would I have an agent? I never had a job." But the owner.
By the way, the drapes behind you make it look like nothing has changed.
No, that's my first day.
Those are pantaloons.
So it's usually up, but I lowered it so it wouldn't be too bright. And now look what I'm getting.
It's nice. There's no brightness behind you. It's good.
So I didn't have a manager, an agent, and Richie Tinkin. Do you remember Richie? He was one of the owners of the comic strip.
Yeah.
He was down there in Florida, and he was going to be my advisor. I guess he was managing. No, he wasn't managing Eddie Murphy yet. I don't know if that was yet. Maybe it was. Anyway.
I don't think so. I don't think it was Eddie was old enough yet.
He was 81. Maybe it was too early. So he read the script and he said, "Well, you know, I'll see if I can, you know, help you out." He read the script and he went, "What's your character's name?" I said, "Modell." And he said with a straight face, "I don't know how to tell you this. You ain't in this."
Right.
I said, "No, I'm supposed to be improvising later." He goes, "Well, as it is, you got nothing." I went, "I know." But anyway. And I had to broker, I got scale, it's $11 a week. And Yeah, but that was, you know, literally my first job, and I stepped in, you know, some little nice pile of gold there, because that really opened up every other door.
And it was the door that opened Barry Levinson's life. I mean, yeah, it was his trilogy of Baltimore life.
Yeah.
You know, all the way from Ten and Men to...
It's kind of astounding, because he had never directed before, and yet he was so self-assured and really went upstream. Like, there was no movie where dialogue was like that or actors talked like that. And he said, no, that's what it is. The studio thought they were getting Porky's. You know, went, oh, guys, where's the sex? No, it's not that. Well, where's the jokes? There's no jokes. Where's the hijinks? It's like, no, it's guy. The famous story that he always told was, like, they showed it, and he showed the scene in the diner where I'm asking Gutenberg for the sandwich. And the studio has said, why doesn't he just give him a sandwich and get on with the story? And Barry goes, there is no story. That's the story. It's those guys. So he was very...
It's pre-Seinfeld. I mean, it's pre... Yeah. Talking about, you know, can I have the salt? Why do you hoard the salt? The kind of
right
dialogue.
There was nothing.
But then you kept acting continuously after that. You did so many. You have quite an interesting collage of movies.
Yeah, it was kind of kooky. Is the way things led. Like, I think Marty Brest, who directed Beverly Hills Cop, saw Diner and thought, gee, he'd be good for something. And I had this little role in Beverly Hills Cop. And then Jim Cameron had seen Beverly Hills Cop when he was looking to cast Aliens. So, you know, you never know what's out there. And of course, the things that you think you're most proud of, like, nobody saw that. And then, like, some little thing, somebody goes, oh, I need that. But yeah, so things worked out. And then I don't know what it was. I guess it was after my two dads, and then somebody.
That we got to hit that for a second, because that happened when Full House happened. So,
right.
I was stuck in the luxury of a sitcom, a family sitcom that you were working on doing, a teenage sitcom with Greg Evigan and a lovely young lady who apparently was a bastard of some kind, bastardess. We didn't know who the dad was.
We didn't know. Hence the tension.
Which is almost the subject matter you would deal with today. And it's pretty lascivious.
No, everybody said, why don't you take a test? Because then you got no show, which frankly, I don't know that they had a show anyway. But so we were both in very similar shows. And my takeaway from that, and I always try to not speak ill, because so many people love, you know, grew up and loved that show.
Right.
And to me, it was really an education, because I learned how to do television, and I'd learned, you know, what a work week looks like, what scripts look like, and so on. But I also learned from my own taste what I would and would not want to do going forward. Because that show, it's like people, the comment you'd always hear, or I would always hear, is like, oh, my little daughter loves that show. My little niece loves that show.
Well, right.
Great. I would like to be on a show that people my age say, oh, man, I like that. And so when that show was over, I was really in no particular hurry to do another half hour. And then somebody, a studio approached me and said, why don't you develop something for yourself? I said, well, I don't have like a million. There are guys who have a million ideas. I said, if I was going to do anything, it would be really small. I said, you know, like in my act, like at the time, my wife at Paula, we weren't even married. She had just moved out. We were living together, and I had all this material maybe we were newly married. Yeah, we were newly married. And I said, you know, a show like about a married couple that's really small. I go, well, write that. I said, all right. And then that, you know, again, lucky. That
It's very much years later, Raymond followed suit. Not that much later, but
when they often will come looking for comics, and it's like, but comics will come good and bad. They will come with their own persona. So it's like, you know, in a good way, it's sort of half written, but you have to write to what you know and what your strength. I mean, Raymond was, you know, Phil Rosenthal was brilliant, but it started with him taking Raymond's persona and his family story. And
right.
For me, I mean, I was literally stealing stuff from, you know, arguments I'd have with Paul. I go, oh, put that in the show.
Yeah. And that's the truth. That's what we saw Phil just the other day. And he's always eating. I don't understand.
Nobody
that.
Feed him. They're he taking needs- it very literally. We have lunch with Phil, and I feel a little bit of pressure when I'm with Phil. And when he goes, this is the best bread, I go, It's okay.
By the way, it cut my lip. I have very sensitive lips. Did you have that?
I've always said you have very sensitive lips and lovely eyes.
That's why we're friends. So that's why it took no time to get back into our friendship after 50 years. After 90 years. We're still not old yet, you know. This is third act time.
We're on our way. But
everybody is. I mean, when you think about it, the moment you're born, you're waiting.
You're on your way, but not like you and me. We are really... We're like second to last stop.
I was talking to Bill Burr and I said, you know, I haven't even done what I came here to do. He said, well, you better fucking hurry up.
Yeah. You guys, see, I stepped away when Mad About You started in 92. I didn't do stand up for the longest time. And it wasn't deliberate. I was never one of these guys that said, I don't want to do it. But I just got really consumed with the show. And then in the summers as well. You know, and I was, you know, Jerry somehow was able to do his show and then do stand-up. I can never have the clarity of mind to do it. And then when the show was over, I was really looking forward to not doing anything. I was just taking it easy, being home. I had a new baby. But stepping away, so all these guys, like I never met, like all these guys were huge. Like I've never met Bill Burr. I don't believe, maybe years ago, I don't remember. I never met Louis. I never met Chappelle. All these guys we were talking about, like,
yeah,
guys who grew up, who were formed, even without me giving them the say so. They managed to have a career even without having coffee with me. And it doesn't seem right.
Yeah, they didn't get to have all your advice.
Yes, I could have helped them.
You would have said, kid, don't care so much about stand up. You know, but the thing with me is I couldn't stop. I went and directed for a while. So
You were good at it.
Thanks. I'm working on something now. And then I'd love to have you in it if you're available.
Very expensive. Plus,
No, I've seen the drapes. You need the little cash. I know you made a lot of money, but I'm just saying those drapes
most
don't.
Most of it went into the drapes. That's those are $20 bills.
Are they lined with bitcoins?
They are lined with bitcoins.
So the thing is, I just stopped doing stand-up for like 4 years. I just did the directing. And after I was done doing America's Funniest Home Videos and Full House, I just didn't want to be seen by anybody because I just wanted to hide. And so I directed. And then I thought, I'm just going to direct. And then Dirty Work was not a hit, even though it's a cult favorite. And I directed other stuff. And then when I don't want to be a service person, I don't want to be directing television shows and movies of the week at that time were still happening. They still happen rarely now. Right. You have to get a good HBO one or a good. And so I found out that I just, there's something for me that viscerally hits me as a stand-up. And then I just started thinking of things more and more. So, but yours came out the same way most of the great stand-ups happened. That had a sitcom.
I should have been out there while the show was on. It would have been, would have been very lucrative. But I didn't want to just dust off my act from 5 years earlier and here's the old jokes.
No, you need to redo it.
And so I took off time and it was probably 10 years after the Mad About You was over. And I just felt like it's time. And I just went into the clubs and it was very weird because it was different because I go into a Comedy Magic Club down on Hermosa Beach.
Yeah, that's where I saw you and it felt so good. And
yeah, it was nice. It was a reunion. But I remember I went up and the audience now, they know you. They go, oh, and I'm going, oh shit, they're going to be disappointed. I got nothing. I'm just really standing up for the first time, literally. And it was one of those things where actually it's like, you know, if you play basketball your whole life and then you don't play for a while, your muscles atrophy. You still know how to do it, but the muscles aren't firing. And that's what I felt. I was up there going, come on. And it's all in there. It's not your body. But it took me a solid year till I felt comfortable enough to, you know, perform on my own.
It's a true muscle that has to be exercised. And I'm not being dirty for a change. And I went and did the Dave Chappelle summer camp thing, which was very gracious of him. And I just loved it. But I didn't know what
That's
I was
hard.
Doing. I didn't know what I was doing. I hadn't done it for so long. And I got up there and everything was okay. I did a comedy song about people being good to each other and stuff, you know, kind of relevant. It still dealt with my penis. So I was comfortable.
There you go. Sure.
But it is, I mean, I remember watching Richard Pryor at the Comedy Store, and it's on Mike Binder's Comedy Store directory.
Okay.
His Rolodex, his documentary on Showtime, and Richard would get up, and sometimes he was just trying stuff out, and that's the bravery. That's the bravery.
It is a very brave. It's a very brave thing, but to me, what impacted me, impressed me, was when I went back to doing this, and this is eight, nine years ago, I guess. I didn't have the skill, and I was rusty, and I didn't, and it took me a while. It's also like, why are you here? Because the audience is going, I remember younger comics would go, hey, well, what are you doing here? You doing a special? No. You doing a Tonight Show? No. And why are you here? I went, to remember how to do it. But what came back, it was just as exciting and challenging and frustrating and thrilling as it was when we were 18
yeah.
or 20. And I remember, you know, driving the 40-minute drive from the Comedy and Magic Club, if I had a one line that worked, the drive back was so victorious. And if I had a new, oh, I worked on it, it's gonna be great. The drive down was so exciting. And I went, how many things in life are as exciting as they were when they were 18? Not many.
No. You know?
And it was that.
And it's always said by anybody I've ever respected, and I found it myself, if I come up with a piece of lengthy conversation, not necessarily a bit because that sounds so cheesy for what I'm trying to accomplish, but if you get a new laugh and it becomes part of whatever it's going to end up, whether it's just going up again or whether you're going to do a special, because I'd love to see a special out of you, to be honest. I'd love to see you hone something because you have a lot of chops and
I would
a lot.
Love to do a special now. I'm ready. For the last couple of years, I said, I don't know that I want to, but I would like to. It's funny, when I went back up a couple of years ago, whatever it was, I remember, you know, if I got 5 minutes together, I was like, oh my gosh, that's true. And like a month later, I was like, I got 7 minutes. And I remember talking to Sebastian Maniscalco, another guy who was like, he wasn't as big as he gotten in the last couple of years.
But, right.
You know, but whatever, 8 years ago, he was headlining, and I said, geez, this guy is funny. I go, oh, yeah, he's a big headliner. Yeah, well, I was not familiar.
He's incredible.
And he's a sweet guy. And I said, so when you headline, how long do you do? He said, like an hour, hour 10. An hour? That's impossible. What? And now, I can't do less than an hour. I don't know how to. It's funny how you grow into it. Like, well, now that feels comfortable. An hour feels. And I've done like an hour 30, which is probably pushing it, but I'm going, it's
not when you feel good, not when it feels right.
Yeah, and when it's going well, and it's really spending time with, you know, them. I think we've all come to appreciate what we didn't as younger comics. When somebody comes to see you, it's like, that's such an effort. You know what I mean? Like, you got in your car, you bought a ticket,
they paid.
You got dressed, hopefully. Because I know, you know, sometimes I'll say to Paul, I go, oh, somebody's coming. I go, oh, James Taylor's coming to town. I love him. You want to go? I'm not going to go, but I like him. So you guys came. You drove in. You got excited. You sat through the opening act. God bless you. And then it's like, how can you not, you know, do your best for these people
and be appreciative. It's really and it takes us back to, you know, we have to take a break. Watch this. You're going to love this break. We're going to take a quick break from people that help pay for this.
I'll change the curtains.
Oh yeah, please do anything.
Watch what happens. Okay,
we'll be right back. Okay, we're back, and you're trying we're back from the commercial, and you're changing the curtains.
Hold on. See, that's no good.
I don't think you should do that. I think it looks like you're lifting a girl's petticoat. It's just, whatever you've got with that drape thing, it's from the 20s.
It's not. It's just been up there so long.
Now, who put it there? Did Paula put it there?
Your mother. I don't know who put it there. By the way,
did you rent that room? Are you staying at an Airbnb right now?
This is all virtual background. My actual house is a shithole, but with good curtains.
It's really nice to have a virtual background that's just shitty.
And like, yeah, so I could have put like palm trees, but I went, no, let me go with shitty curtains and a fireplace or a cave. I don't know what that is.
And the lamp that looks like it doesn't work.
Doesn't.
No, and to turn it on would be distracting.
Yeah.
So
I'm so glad we had this time together.
You going to sing the whole thing and pull your ear? So here's the thing. I'm watching this show. I'm lucky enough that you gave it to me. It's out right now on Peacock. And it's called There's Johnny. And it's the most beautiful homage to this guy, even though the writers are shitting themselves. And you've got Tony Danza being Freddie DeCordova. And, I mean, it's... this Levy actress.
Jane Levy.
Holy crap. She's so good.
And we made the show 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I think. And afterward, we just did 7 episodes. And then last year she did Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, and which has become a hit. And she's a star. She's working her tail off on that. And she's dancing and singing. But she's spectacular. And that's why I was so happy that this show got a new life. You know, it was on Hulu for 2 years, not so as to not disturb anybody. They didn't they didn't want people to know. And then when their 2-year contract or whatever was up, it just evaporated. And I thought, well, this has to go somewhere. And Peacock launched this summer. I said, well, that should be on Peacock. We have the Peacock in our opening credit. It's an NBC, it takes place at Tonight Show, NBC, in 1972. So, and Jane's an NBC star. And they went, yeah, it should be on Peacock. So I was thrilled that it's got a second life so people can see it. Largely for her. I've seen these all 1,000 times and edited them, and she makes me cry every time. I mean, she's funny and she's quirky, but she's so emotional and she's almost as complex and messed up as not messed up, but as complex as this character. And the heart of the show is this wide-eyed 19-year-old kid fresh off a farm in Nebraska stumbles his way into a entry-level job at the Tonight Show. And the first person he meets is this Jane Levy, who is beautiful, but child of Beverly Hills. His father, her father is this big time troubled agent. Her parents are divorced. She, her thing with men is she'll chew them up and spit them out. And these people should never have met. And it's really the spark of the show. So for me, the fun is young people are watching these people and guys like you and me going, oh, can we see the Carson clips that are embedded in the show?
And seamlessly, if it wasn't for the quality change, simply because that was the quality of the tape, it's done really remarkably. I mean, we both were in that studio. We both were with Johnny. I never did stand up on there. I would sit on the couch. How about you? Do your panel guy.
I stand up once when Diner came out in 82, my first time I did stand up. And then there on after I did sit down, which was... such a treat because you got to take your material and split it with Carson and, you're playing tennis with a master.
And he adored you. He
was really nice to me. Yeah. I was
same here. You were on it a lot.
I was on a lot. And but there was something, the way he would say, he knew what you were going to do. He had your material.
Yeah.
He had your bullet points, but wasn't he like just great at setting you up
and David did the same thing, but and David was more publicly ornery, on the show. You knew how he stood about things, and Johnny was more ornery off camera,
And also with Letterman, when he would set you up, but he would make no qualms about being obvious about it. So it says here, And Johnny would always endeavor to make it seem organic. Even if you go, you'd see through it. He goes, somebody told me. Somebody told me. It's written.
I heard. And you saw his, he didn't lift his cards up. But David was of a new time. I mean, it
almost
was
an anti-Johnny in a way.
But it was self-aware, which was what we all were drawn to, was that. Kind of stand-up I did anyway, was self-aware. Even if it was blue, it was... Or not, it was still
Johnny,
away the curtain.
He would, when I've looked at old tapes, and I marvel at how skilled and gracious and subtle he was, that when you were on a roll, he stepped back. And many a time I would just go on a little too long, or I would just get lost in the weeds, and he would give you a new question, or he would jump in, or if it was really going bad, he would have fun with you about, boy, that joke tanked, didn't it? I remember I did one time I had a bit that I thought would be, I thought was going to be funny. I had done The Marrying Man with Alec Baldwin movie. And I thought, instead of coming out, I didn't even have a good clip. There was nothing that I did. So I said, well, maybe I'll do a joke about clip. I'll say, you know, John, I wasn't able to get a clip in time, but I brought some storyboards. I drew some pictures. Maybe this was, and I had a friend who's an artist drew up like, I don't know, 10, 12 big poster boards, stick figures. You see, this is Alec Baldwin driving. I'm in the back. That's me. You can see. This is, I'm right, boom, we're driving. And then this one, and by the third card, it's just not funny.
Right, right.
And Johnny was just like looking at me, and literally, I think on air said something like, "No, go ahead. This is your funeral." I went, "Oh, that was so fun that he was that became funnier than the bit was gonna be. The idea right. that I was dying and he was gonna watch me sweat. I went, "Oh, this is really special."
I did something with him that I would always do, and I was on both their shows like I don't know, 13 to 15 times or something, and you kind of memorize them. But my abacus is. There was an earthquake, so it got thrown off of how many episodes. But I would say to Johnny, and I would riff. I would go fast. You were slow and friendly. I would kind of speed up when I was telling a story, accelerate it a little bit. And I said, okay, this is true. And Johnny would sit there with his hand on his face and go, I don't care. Just tell it. Which is, again, it's like your own funeral. It's like he's playing along. And he's helping you die and get you out of it. And Letterman did the same thing to me. Letterman go, I don't care if it's true or not. I don't give a crap. You know, I don't know why I just did a bad impression of Johnny doing David. I can't do David.
But Letterman sort of didn't really care if you did bad.
That's the truth. And Johnny, one night I was on there, and you'll appreciate this. And you know, because I knew David from the club, from the Comedy Store. So there was something so I could have conversation in between. I wasn't close with him by any means. Right. But with Johnny, he took a liking to me, probably like he did with you, as like a nephew kind of person. Because we're all kind of related.
And he was a different generation.
Correct. And I watched him just like what you put in the show. Just like the kids watching him at the beginning of the show, of your series. And I was 10. And I told him this on an episode once. I was celebrating New Year's with Johnny when he was 90 minutes long. And I was visiting Cousin Tootsie in Washington. And I was on the show talking to him about it. And then at one point, we go to commercial. And at that time, I would have like two segments of panel because life was good at that moment.
Right.
For a couple of years. And Johnny said, sorry, the audience is off. And I went, no, they seem great. He goes, no, they suck. You were really good, though. And I went, well, they seemed good to me. And then I looked at him and I said, so what do you do if they're off? And he looked at me and I knew he'd said it before in this Obi-Wan Kenobi type fashion. And he went, there's always tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, he loved comics and he loved, you know, I don't know that that was as true with Letterman. I mean, I think Letterman would have as much fun with an actor, but Johnny seemed to really love comics. And I didn't have that with Letterman because I didn't grow up in the Comedy Store, so I didn't have that history with him. But Johnny would like to see the thought process. I mean, you know, if you're dying or if you're, you know, he was in it with you, which was, you know, and doing this show, doing that, there's Johnny, it was such a flashback because those clips that we put in there, Carlin and Albert Brooks, I remember them very clearly. And I haven't seen him in 45 years. But television, it meant more, A, because there weren't that many choices. You couldn't record it, right? So if you missed it, you missed it. It's not going to come around again. And you couldn't watch it tomorrow on your phone in the shower. So for us, you know, I remember, you know, we would know days in advance, George Carlin is on Thursday, and we'd be there and watch it. And it really did bring me back like that kid. I remember sitting, I'll tell you a funny thing. We had, you know, our producer, our partner on this was Jeff Sotzing, who was Johnny's nephew, who produced The Tonight Show. But he started like the kid on There's Johnny. He was a young, out of college, and he was Johnny's boy. So nobody.
Did he help you get all these clips? Because it's you got full access to the whole party.
Yeah, that was
you couldn't have done it without it, but.
When we started talking about the show, Johnny was alive. It was many years in the works, and we wanted their cooperation. But one day, we built the set exactly as it was in 1970.
Oh, I couldn't believe it. That really took me.
Yeah. So it was really lifelike. So one day we're on the set, and just between takes, Jeff, Johnny's nephew and producer, and our producer, he had brought in some CDs of Doc Severinsen and the band, the full music stuff that they would do while the audience at home is watching commercials. They would play these 2-3 minute pieces.
Right.
So it was between takes, and I'm sitting, and Tony Danza was sitting on the couch as Freddie, and I went over and I was sitting next to Tony, and we're just sitting there, we're not talking, and the music's playing, and we both fell into this sense memory of like, we've both thought we were on a commercial break, because here's Doc playing, we're on the couch waiting for John, we go, oh my God, this set is really good, and we bought it. It was that lifelike.
Where did you shoot that?
We shot it at Red Studios, which used to be, I think, Lorimar. It was the same stage where we ended up shooting the new Mad About You's last year, and where Dick Van Dyke shot and I Love Lucy. So we thought, wow. But that was...
The barn doors, what about the outside, the exterior? Was that NBC?
That exterior we went to...
The gate was.
No. When we won... One thing, they went to the old Burbank studio. And then the other stuff, when we came in close, we were not in the Burbank studios. But
because this show's made for me. I mean, I'm watching it, and
have you gotten to the end yet?
I have, and it's you've got quite an arc. I mean, what I love about what you've done is you've made a heartbreaking show as well.
It is pretty heartbreaking, and that's, to me, that's always the fun stuff when, you know, the shows that have. It's really silly and really big laughs and then some really real stuff. There's a lot of stuff going on, 72. And, you know, the character has a brother who's off in Vietnam, and there's that story. And her, you know, the Jane Levy's character had some troubles at home. But
they're parallel problems. I mean, it's really, I'm not spoiler alerting, but I recommend everybody watch the whole thing. And it's
really great. And I'll tell you, we had the only good note I've ever gotten from a studio when we wrote all the scripts, and they said, is there anything you could put in that would maybe sort of just give it a small arc for the whole season? Like, for example, could it be the 10th anniversary show? I said, well, that's actually really great. Well, once we had that idea that, over the course of our 7 shows, they're working up to the 10th anniversary show. Out of that came all these stories. And then, there's a little piece of news that happens in the final episode. And then there's a party where they, right? So we don't see Johnny Carson on the show, only as the Tonight Show. We find out that on the day of the 10th anniversary, there was a party afterwards. Johnny's ex-wife, Joanna, had the tape of that party.
I was wondering how the hell you got that at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
And so we had a story where they're going to go to a party. It's fiction, but their film exists of the party that we're talking about. We went, that's really fortuitous. So that was kind of thrilling.
And it's a big announcement he makes.
And he makes a very big announcement at that party. But
go ahead.
No, but it was.
I'm effusive about it.
For me, it was like we have accidentally stumbled into some blending where our fiction really meets up with reality. I mean, there's Johnny after that taping.
I can't wait for everybody that knew him of all ages, you know, our group and older, and Peter LaSalle is still, knock on wood, healthy at this time. And Peter was very instrumental in my career. So was Freddie, but then Freddie was kind of really overshadowed in my time by Peter. It changed. But there's a moment on the show, real footage with Jerry Lewis on the show, and that's the price of admission for anybody that knows anything about show business or the Rat Pack or the dynamic of Jerry and Dean, and that's the underlying heaviness.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of layers. But that moment was chilling. There's a moment where the 10th anniversary show, and this was on the air. And it's an interesting lesson to be had and a takeaway. The 10th anniversary show, which apparently Johnny Carson didn't want to do, but they moved away from their regular desk. They made big couches and they didn't just have one guest. They had 5, 10. they had, you know, Hall of Fame. They had Jack Benny and Jerry Lewis and Don Rickles and George Burns and Rowan and Moore. And so you think, well, that's going to be 10 times as funny. It was overkill. And they were all tripping over each other. And there was this thing in the air that they're all going, this is dying. And Johnny was sort of not wanting to be there. And you could feel it. And I said, well, we have to write to that. We have to write to, oh, this is going in the toilet, which it was, which is, you know,
Jerry thing especially, because he kind of says what he thinks of him at that moment.
Yeah, Jerry, and I got to know Jerry Lewis a little bit. He did an episode of Mad About You, and I saw that bristly, you know, the Nutty Professor. Those were really his two extremes. He was Buddy Love, and he was Ray. And in real life, he could become bristly like that.
And you think about where he was in his career when he had the big office at Paramount, and he was the king of show business for 10 years. Yeah. After he and Dean split up and he was making movie after movie, it really went, the ego just went completely out of control. Doesn't mean he didn't do brilliant work.
He was very volatile. And there was, I had always heard that I had heard that Jerry believed Johnny didn't like him. And then we found this tape where Johnny gives
him proves it.
Which proves it. You go, oh, I guess that's why he thought that. There's a line we put in there where the writer's going, before Freddie's looking at Jack Benny and George and Don Rickles and Joey Bishop, you know, it's a lot of funny Jews. One of the guys goes, yeah, not tonight.
Yeah, thing that was interesting. I would imagine a lot of the budget was in footage and in editing and in the actors that you had, but you're still working on a low budget.
It was pretty tight budget. The footage was not, that was part of our blessed deal. We had, you know, access. I mean, we had to pay a nominal fee for each clip or something, but
it wasn't Carson Productions. It was separate. It wasn't like it had to be owned by the estate.
It was Carson Entertainment Group is one of the producers.
Oh, it was?
Yeah. It was in conjunction with them. And
I didn't see the card. I didn't see the card.
I did not know that.
It was a very
ambitious show. It's period, you know. So, you know, a lot of things that I wanted to do that we had written. We was driving around. It's like, well, wait a minute. You want to drive? You got modern buildings. You got modern cars. How are you gonna like? All right, and then it becomes, what if he just goes to the parking lot and there's two cars from 1970? That's cheaper. But you know what? And you know this as a director, a lot of times the constraints that you're kicking against actually help you. You know what? It was funnier. And we didn't waste a day driving around silly drive-by shots.
No, it's relationship. It's wonderful.
The opening scene in the opening episode where he meets the guy and again to a thing. That was supposed to be in her apartment. And we go, well, we can't afford another apartment. What if he just goes downstairs? That's better. We're done by lunch. And we had David Gordon Green, who is a terrific, really great director. And I had worked with him on a show called Red Oaks, which was on Amazon. And when I was developing this, I said, I could use you. He read it and said, yeah, let's do it. And he was great. He really helped shape.
Did he do all of them?
No, he did the first one only, but he picked the other directors and guys that he and women he had worked with. And I learned an awful lot. You know, we had the first episode is always the trickiest. And we had this very long beginning until he gets to California. And David said, well, what if you just take that piece and put that over here? Like the opening shot was actually from the ending. And they said, what if you open with that? I went, and you sort of just throw all your plans in it. Resettles and you go, oh, well, I never would have thought of that. That's terrific. You know, I'm when I finish writing something in my head, I go, well, that's, you know, that's the Bible. It's done. That's it. And then somebody smart goes, what if you move this? And you go, even better.
I relish that. I love when it's collaboration, but you have to be with great people to be able to do that.
You do.
And I loved walking down the hallways of the dressing rooms because you really mirrored it. I mean, you really did do it. I mean, it became cement, not as much woodwork. Your house looks more like the...
That was Johnny's curtain, actually. I don't know if you know, that's why it's a little wrinkles.
He might have worn it as a kilt in one of the sketches. we're going to take one more break, and then we're going to come back.
I'll be here.
Okay, we're back. See? A Jew doesn't have a big attention.
Like Maxwell House coffee.
I don't have to. Well, back to. I hate to bring up. There's Johnny on Peacock right now. People have to watch all the episodes. How many total?
We did 7.
Not enough. Not enough.
No. You know what? My hope is that with your help, how many people will watch your podcast?
At least 7.
7. All right. So if each person who's watching watches There's Johnny and then writes to NBC, Comcast, and Peacock and says we need more.
Right.
I would not argue. I would love to make more. We have a lot of stories that we didn't get to tell. Of course, we can't afford Jane Levy and Tony Danza. They all did.
But maybe it could, because it, you know, with success comes a little bit of a budget. It has a feeling of My Favorite Year to it.
Yeah.
Which is also one of my fave movies. And you it do. Also, did you think about acting in it at one point?
No. I was happy. I love being on the other side. I mean, I love acting too, but I love when I get to write it and be on the set and say, tell the director, try this, or tell the actor, try that. And, but also it was, would have distracted, because, you know, we're saying it's real and it's 72. I didn't do the Tonight Show till 82. So I think it would have broken the frame to whatever extent anybody would give a shit. But no, I was happy to not be in it.
This is the Tonight Show we watched. This is the one we watched as kids. This time period.
Do you know, there's a story. I don't know. Do you know the story? Did I tell you the story? When I was 15, George Carlin came to my house. Do you know the story?
Yeah, you did. But would you tell it?
Well, just in a nutshell. In a nutshell, 1972. So I was 16, I guess. And George Carlin was playing at the Palace Theater in New York. My sister, who was older than me, had somehow managed to get him to do an interview for a college radio show, her college radio show. And wherever they were going to meet, he ended up coming to our house. And I was out of the house and I came back and there's George Carlin. And to me, it was like the Beatles and George Carlin. That's how big he was. And he did like a 2-hour interview and then he stayed for breakfast because my parents would not let him go without eating. It was a circus. And I just found the cassette, which was mind blowing. But anyway, when I found this clip that we use in episode 1 of There's Johnny, that was a week after he was in my house. And I was looking at him and he said, you know, the election's coming up. And suddenly my whole life sort of came together. I go, that story that I've been telling my friends, George Carlin was in my house, that was days later. And now it's 50 years later and I'm making a show about that week. And it just kind of blew my mind in a way that I can't really put all the pieces together. But the thing that was also, by the way, I don't know if you felt this watching it, George Carlin, he was doing his bit, but he was, you know, talking to one of the other guests. And the other guest was a guy that they very deliberately put with George, was this psychologist, sex therapist, doctor who was almost an evangelist.
And very forward talk. I mean, Johnny was really saying expletive.
Yes. And
explicit.
Johnny actually on the air said fellatio. I went, first of all, that's not how you say it.
He said cunning lingus, I believe.
Well, he said one of them.
Yeah, he did.
But the thing is, so two things.
Cunning lingus.
How Johnny loved the sparks that were flying, because here was like the two polar opposites of that moment in culture. George Carlin and this evangelical, you know, Dudley Do-Right. But as much as they were trying to make friction, George was really earnestly trying to make a point. He was trying to go, no, but let me understand. When you say that, why do you? And you could see his comedy mojo sort of evaporate. He went, just go ahead. And at the end, and this was not in our show, but I saw the whole clip. At the end, when they came back for credits, George so graciously said, forgive me if I seemed rude. I was just really trying to understand you. I went, where's that level of civility? You know, it was so.
Oh, we don't even have it. And look at him coming out as we're watching clips of him today that are incredibly relevant as a prophet of what we're going through right now.
Totally.
I mean, we're living it.
So, you know, and we miss his voice, you know, and imagine if George Carlin was around, if John Lennon was around. It's like we need people better than you and me to be inspiring.
You're pretty great. And I'm trying to do my part.
You're trying. I know you are. See, I'm not even that brave. I dip my toe in a water of something important. I go,
Oh, you got stuff to do. I'm telling you, you're a young man. We hang out with Norman Lear. He tells us we're babies.
We're so young. Go, that's thank why we hang you. Out. Yes. Norman and Mel Brooks, we go, we're like puppies.
Oh, blessed people. So this here's a quick. A little smart, right? Just a little.
What?
Norman. Norman Lear, yeah. Just a little smart.
Well, I mean, there's nobody who's done life like Norman Lear has to have had the success and the cultural impact and then the smarts. And you know what's inspiring? I mean, we're so lucky. We know we're lucky that we get to hang out with Norman Lear and these guys. And
Mel Brooks was on Mad About You, right?
Mel Brooks was on Mad About You. And
Carl, you know, was on Mad About You. Carl Reiner. Everybody was on Mad About You.
Carl did it. We had Sid Caesar, Shecky Green. but that the amazing thing, not so many amazing things, but that Carl, to the very end, Carl Reiner, passed a couple of months ago, 98, he knew every up-and-coming stand-up. He would say, did you catch this guy? Did you see this guy? Oh, she's so smart. I'm going, how do you know? I mean, it was a genuine passion. He loved comedy. Excuse me. And Norman, too. He knows.
Yeah. They both called me out of the blue years ago and said, I want to go to lunch with you.
Wow.
And I went, well, it's about fucking time.
Yeah, good. And I put them in their place.
What's wrong with you, you legend?
Wow.
Well, let me ask you questions because I went through the reboot of Full House. You did the reboot of Mad About You. What was that experience for you? And do you wish you were doing it longer?
I don't wish we were doing the original show longer. I thought we did it exactly as long. That was so satisfying. We did 7 years. We did every episode we wanted to do. We landed the plane nicely and we walked away. And we would, Helen Hunt and I, we would have lunch all the time. We would joke, so, you know, someplace, hey, we'll do the reboot, the reunion. Where are they now? And it was like the last thing we ever wanted to do. So much so that when we finished the original series, we did our 1 hour finale. We glimpsed into the future to show people what happened to them. And the marriage wasn't all smooth. They separated for a while, bumps, but they ended up. And we thought that way we'll never be even tempted to come back because we've answered all the questions. You saw what happened. But when everybody was doing these reboots, you know, we kind of were forced to talk about it. And we were very reluctant because we just didn't want to open up. What if we mess up the memory of that? It was so good.
Right.
But then we thought, well, we're not going to suck. We know we'll be good. So the fun part was like, well, it'll be fun to play together. That was the joy.
Exactly.
And then we thought, well, there's actually a story to tell because it's about a couple and we haven't seen them in 20 years because they've been busy raising a child who's a handful. But as you know, when a child leaves the house, suddenly it's back to what was before. And I remember in my house, you know, a couple of years ago when my younger son left for college, you know, the dynamic in the house with Paula was, so what were you saying in 1997? What did you say? Where were we? What the hell just happened?
And you're
not those people. You're not young. You don't have your life full of dreams. It's like, oh, life is, you know, taking its toll on you. And you have to decide, you know. So we did, and we said, well, let's do it once. We did 12 and they were really good. And
yeah, very much so.
Please. And how did you feel going back? Was it?
We were more like guests. They called us the legacy cast. So they would open up like you were in Aliens, right? You know, the chamber that you sleep in.
Yeah,
and like then they open it after 1,000 years.
Yeah.
That's what we were in, basically. They opened it up. We came out. We'd do an episode and then we'd go back. So that was, you know, quite a fascinating experience. It was fun. It was fun to see everybody. It was on for 6 years, which is really, really nice. You know, that's the advantage of being able to see everybody. But I never stopped seeing everybody from the show. It's like you're saying you go to lunch with Helen.
Yeah.
So, you know.
What was interesting, and we had all seen each other over the years, but never as a group. So when we got together for the first table read, it was delightful and warm. And, you know, here's my kid. Now your baby's married. And it was life had happened. But when we got on the set for that first day, it was weird because it really felt like we had not been gone for a day.
That's what happened to me too. Right, when they rebuild the damn set.
Yes, you know, 7 steps to the door, to the kitchen, and it all came back and we just, you know, other than walking slower, you know, our joke was that the scripts only have to be half as long because now every other line is what? And then you have to repeat. So I didn't hear, come in the room.
I didn't have to write my lines down as much as I used to. I used to write them on the back of the kids' heads, you know, pots and pans. I did write on pots and pans. I wrote on my line on a
really?
When it's a line that's not well written or it's just a handle, like what's going on? Hey, guys, you know, I'd write it on a pencil. I'd literally on a pencil.
But it's not the line so much as when do I say it? And you can't write that down.
I don't know what to do. No, I remember their mouth stops moving. And the worst actors, of course, are the people that we didn't hopefully never have to work with. But I direct them sometimes accidentally when they move their mouth while the other person's talking.
Oh.
That's always a little trick.
We had this, you know, the running joke with Helen. You know, it was 90% of our, so much of it was, you know, a two-hander, is the two of us. And if she was silent for a minute, the other, either one of us was quiet, the other one goes, oh, shit, must be me.
You're exactly.
Talking. I'm talking.
Right. The guy in the outtakes that goes, is that me? You know,
yeah.
I'm the one that just, Bob, you don't have to say it. Just take a pause and say it.
Take a pause.
Now, here, I got to ask you about this because I am obsessed with Stranger Things. Okay, the kids are going to be 45 by the time it comes back on because of the pandemic. I mean, I'm watching it. You're hurt. I'm worried about you. You're a great doctor. You care.
Well,
you're coming back. We know you're coming back. Where are you? What's happening? Are they going to shoot? Are the kids going to be 90?
The kids are 90. Yeah, well, you know, Stranger Things, you're not allowed to talk about it. I can't even tell you.
Yeah, it's good to sign an NDA.
Yeah, but here's the great thing. People would come after the season. I was on the second season of Stranger Things. And people would say, what's going to happen next year? I go, let me explain something. I don't understand what happened last year. I was in it. So, like, I don't, you know.
I know there's an upside down something. I don't know if it's a cake.
Periodically, I would say to the Duffer Brothers, I go, so what's happening? So they're coming through the portal, and then it would explain it to me in these sci-fi terms, and it just does not
right.
register. And I would end up going, I'll just talk to the green screen and you'll put it in later. Whatever.
Your guilt comes from going, and how does that affect my character? Sorry, this is about me, but I don't know who I am or where I am or where I'm going.
Yeah, and I'm supposed to be the doctor who knows everything. And I asked him, when I first met him, what kind of doctor? Like, oh, you're like 7 degrees. You have so many. You are an expert in everything. I said, well, that's going to be tough.
You have that disposition. Since the moment I met you, you had that disposition. You're a perfect shrink.
I'm ready to be a doctor.
Yeah, you should do it now. It's not too late to take night classes.
Yeah. I can just look and say, Bob, that's going to have to come out, you know, and then you'll have to.
Well, that's my penis, so. You're not the first guy that said that.
Hey.
What? No, then they say removed after they see it. That's even worse.
Out and removed.
Right? Now you've been in a lot of movies that I love. And when I see you in them, it makes me goddamn happy. So Aliens was one that made me happy. Now, who directed that movie?
It wasn't you, was it? It wasn't me. Aliens was James Cameron.
It was James Cameron.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he did
At the time, he had only done Terminator and another movie before. I forgot. Not The Beast, something like that.
And he also directed the original Alien?
No, that was Ridley Scott.
That's what I was going for, because Ridley Scott has a show right now on HBO. Have you seen the show that he has right now?
Yeah, I watched a little of it.
It's disturbing. I mean,
I have less and less ability to watch disturbing.
I know, because you watch the news and then you go and you put on, you know,
I need to watch something very, very different. But
porn? Do you and Paula watch a lot of porn?
Watch. We're in it.
Sing it. I wrote
it.
We
got a 3-DVD package coming up. When I say package.
This is the poll I want to bring out. Look what I did to you at the very end. I've got you at your filthiest. Paul Reiser is so blue in the last 40 minutes.
I remember when I guess it was early in Full House, when they suddenly found, you know, somebody put two and two together. Bob Sackett, The Lost Tape. Lost? He was promoting that. He talks dirty. Went, uh-huh. Oh, never mind.
It should have been. And they held out to get me. They actually had to. I feel bad they let go and put me. Yeah, I was doing the morning program on CBS, and then I got let go from that because I was too hot for morning TV. And fortunately, with Full House, you could edit out the stuff I was saying in between. And there were kids, so I did have some, you know,
right.
ethics.
Yes. But it's just so absurd. We found comedy where he says this, and like, yeah, he worked very hard on that comedy.
Now back to you.
All right. Yeah.
Okay. Aliens, a classic film.
Yeah.
You don't, it doesn't end well for you. If I recall the film correctly.
That's true.
But you got to work with the A-Team on everything. So you've got, you know, James Cameron, you've got Sigourney, you've got
Billy Paxton and a whole bunch of great actors.
Yeah.
That was a thrill. My whole thing was that when I read that script, I went, wow. Before I auditioned, I said, this is going to be a big hit. And then when I got it, I said, okay, my job is I just have to, when I'm on screen, I have to not bring the film to a grinding halt. If I can, if people don't just go, what's he doing here? that was my aspiration, to just blend in, and
to not go over to Sigourney and say, are you going to eat those fries?
Yeah. But what was interestingly enough, again, because I worked with Larry Moss on that, like did a lot of work in preparation, just because of the shooting schedule. The first 3 weeks, maybe, I was in scenes where I had no lines. And so I literally was trying to blend into the background, which suddenly was my own neurosis, but it suddenly became, oh, that's a good character thing, because I'm just
right.
Don't let anybody know that I have some thoughts. And so it was an interesting thing where your own, you know, your own mishigas actually ends up sometimes helping you.
People don't know that's acting. People don't, you know, if you're moving around and winking and twitching, that's you're trying to. You know.
I remember watching a documentary on Marlon Brando, and I think it might have even been Carl Malden or somebody of stature saw Streetcar on Broadway, and Marlon Brando, and that when he came on stage, his vibe and just what he was doing was so different than anything anybody had ever done that they actually, for a moment, thought, the janitor, the guy mopping the stage, just walked on. Oh, that's him. Oh, fuck, that's the guy.
Right.
But
it's
surreal. It was just so, not wrong, but different.
Yeah.
So I'm like Brando in that way, that people jump and go, wrong.
You look better. I will say lot better. So the other question I wanted to ask you, what's your favorite acting role that you've had? What's the one that you would be most proud of that people might not know? You did a movie in London.
I'll tell you a thing that very few people saw, but was the joy of my life, was a movie, it's probably 15 years ago already, at least. I did a movie with Peter Falk called The Thing About My Folks. And it was a movie that I wrote for Peter because I wanted to be in a movie where Peter Falk played my father. I just had this feeling. He reminded me of my father. My father loved Peter Falk. That's all I had. And nobody wrote it. So I said, I should probably.
I saw this movie.
And it was really, and it was written, as you can imagine, writing for Peter Falk, you can hear his voice. And it's,
yeah.
So I wrote these speeches and I knew him, you know, I'd met him once enough to call him. I said, I've written this thing, blah, blah. He says, yeah, I'll read it. And he lives not far from me. I drove down the hill, gave him the script. And he says, I'm a slow reader. I said, take your time. But literally, I went home and I just sat by the phone. At 11 o'clock that night, Paula was asleep and I was just sitting by the phone. And it was Peter. He goes, well, this is fantastic. This is fantastic. We got to go do this. I went, I'm done. I don't even have to make this. The fact that he called, the fact that he loved it. And, you know, we went off and made it. And every day I would go, this actually happened. I somehow willed this into being, that I actually got this made. Peter is, and we're driving in the movie. It's this beautiful. It was sort of a fantasy of the road trip I had always wished I had with my dad, and I didn't. Not because he died when I was young or anything. We just never did that. And we had conversations that I always wanted to have with my dad. I just wrote them for me and Peter. And it was filmed upstate New York, and we're driving in the beautiful autumn. It was October. It's like right around now. And we're driving in this antique 1940 something convertible and doing dialogue that I wrote, and it's coming out of Peter Falk's mouth, and I'm going, doesn't have to ever get better than this. This is you know, that was a good little sweet spot of life.
Yeah, well, I want to see it again because I remember loving it. I mean, did he ever pull a Columbo thing, which is like how he would naturally talk? Like when he would go, there's something about this. He walks out of the room, then he comes back. I got one more question for you, Paul.
I had to stop myself from writing those things, but his rhythms were, you know, I'll tell you, I wrote a couple of long scenes for him because I just wanted to hear him talk. And there's one long scene where I question his parenting and what kind of father he was, what kind of husband. And he blows up and he writes this long scene anyway, which he did in one take and it was spectacular. But anyway, I had these long scenes. So right before we shot and we were going to go and he was on board, but we had a meeting with the director and the producers they were still discussing how are we going to film it on video, on film. This was like 2003. So it was like, should we do 16 millimeter, 24, 35 millimeter, 12 frame, 24 frame, all these numbers. Everybody's talking number. And Peter goes, finally, he goes, you know, you're talking about 12, 24, 35, 36. You never shot on 75. And we said, what's 75? He goes, I'm 75 years old. I ain't going to learn all these fucking words. Oh, there you go.
He was
everything. And I'll tell you something else that inspired me. There's one, I had heard from a lot of people that he was really volatile and could be difficult. And I went, I don't know, we already hit it off and he's been nice to me. So I got in, I was on his good side and he knew that I loved him.
Well, you probably also brought up the Cassavetes stuff and, you know, and knowing all of his work with
stuff, but he didn't, you know, and he would share stories and stuff, but he did not ever suffer fools or suck ups. I mean, he was a really salt of the earth guy, which is why he was so appealing, why everybody all over the world loved Columbo. He's, you know,
yeah.
But there was one night where he was having I wrote a piece about this actually. And I wrote a little, what do they call it? It was like a thing on Amazon, these little thin, not quite a book, but anyway, and about stories about people that I've worked with.
Was it a leaflet?
No, it was like Thomas Paine. Yeah, no, it was.
It was a blog of some sort.
It was like
sort.
An iBook. I forget. It's called How to Get to Carnegie Hall. It's like all about. It was about people that I've met, Mel and Carol and Burnett. And
so you wrote a book.
I wrote a little book. I wrote a couple of books, but this was a.
What's
little
it called? So people
it's
can
called
find
How to Get
it.
To Carnegie Hall, and it's on iTunes or Apple. Apple?
Yeah,
it's on
Amazon.
Amazon or Apple. I forget. It's one of those.
It doesn't matter. I'm 75. I'm not going to remember the name.
So anyway, why was I saying? Oh, so there's one night and he had a big scene to do and he was having a problem. And the director, who was very good, but wasn't necessarily communicating well for Peter's sensibilities. And he was moving the camera a lot. And during Peter's speech, Peter goes, well, I don't know when the camera's on me, when it's not. He says, don't worry about it, Peter. You just do your thing. He goes, well, I got to know. I've got to, you know, he's got it all worked out.
Yeah.
He's getting very frustrated. And the director was trying to explain what he was doing. And Peter just kind of blew up. And it was in a restaurant. And he took this big, we're filming in a restaurant. And he takes this huge oak table and he flips it. And he just, and he looked at him like a wild bear, like, come on. And like, he's 75. And his director was 30 something. And we're going, oh, that's, I said, why don't we take a couple of minutes? And everybody settles down. And I went into, let the smoke settle. And I went into his dressing room and he was looking very beaten and ashamed and apologetic. And he said, I just want to get it good. And that's what was driving him. He wasn't trying to be an asshole. He wasn't right. trying to be. He just said, I want to be good and I'm distracted and I don't know how to communicate that. So I flipped the table, but I knew, but I saw it there. He just went, I want to be good. I want the scene to be good. He mattered, you know, and this is at the twilight of his exceptional career. And he was just, I'm doing a scene. You wrote the scene nicely. I want it to be good. And if it's not good, I want, that's how much he cared. It was just, and plus, you know, I loved him to pieces. So it was like that he was pained to kill me. And this one scene that I was talking about before, this long scene where he blows up and he's walking around a car and he's just, it was this fantastic scene, a performance. And when it was over, just the crew just started applauding. And the producer, I happened to be standing next to the producer, a tear, and he said, that's why I'm in movies, to see that. It's like, you know, his performance. I always tell people, you don't have to watch me at all, but just watch him. And there's a gorgeous scene. Olympia Dukakis. Here's a little, Olympia Dukakis played my mother in two movies, that one and another one, but she was married in real life to a wonderful, beautiful guy named, I was gonna say his father, Bert Buckman. Louis Zurich is his real name, but he played my father. I'm Mad About You. So my fake father was married to my fake mother. So that's another thing kept me in therapy for
years. Right. You have a small world when you think about it.
I have a very small world. Finish the joke. So there's a scene in the movie that's a pivotal scene of them coming together and looking at their lives. They're looking at each other and they're in their 70s or late 70s. And they're just trying to look at what went wrong. And it's this tender scene. They had never met till 5 minutes before that. And I wasn't there. I didn't see when they met, but they said hello in a trailer and then they, and action. And they're both crying. And I'm going, how good are these actors? Oh my
right.
God. You watch
right.
them and you go, well, clearly they've lived together for 60 years. No, just met. You know, when you see good acting and you just go, whoa, we got a lot to learn. We have so.
And that's what's to love about acting.
Yeah,
And we'll get to watch it. I remember seeing Peter in a movie that was one of my favorites for a long time, Wings of Desire by Wim Wenders. Yeah. And he's the only one that speaks English in it. And he's Peter Falk in it.
Yeah.
And I won't, if anybody wants to see this movie, it's City of Angels, the Meg Ryan, Nick Cage movie was based on this movie.
Right.
And it is just a special, special movie. And he is, I mean, he's never bad.
He's been in some not great movies, but he's always good. And he's tender and he's funny and he's volatile and he can be broad. You know, he did some Neil Simon.
Well, the In-Laws, I mean, forget it. That will live forever. There's no reason to remake it ever again, please. So what's next for Paul Rudd? No, we can't talk about Stranger Things because there's an embargo. You've got the Kominsky Method will probably be on TV before we know
it. Yes, it'll be on somewhere in 2021. If God willing, we'll have a world.
And do you think you're going to go out? We will have a world. You know we will.
Everybody canceled. You mentioned Canada. I had a whole couple of weeks tour in Canada in the spring. And they just the other way said, yeah, we're going to cancel that till 2022. So I've never had a gig planned for a year, 2 years.
They moved me a year from now. You know, I'd be touring right now.
Into all these theaters. But, you know, no, there's a movie. I wrote this on the second movie that I wrote that I want to do. And we were all ready to go last year. And then different things fell apart. I'm hoping, and it takes place in Ireland. I've always wanted to go. I was in Ireland years ago, and I've always wanted to go back. And just like with the Peter,
it's Paul, wonderful.
Nobody gave me an Ireland movie, so I said, "Well, okay, I'll write it." So,
the Jew from the sitcom world isn't. Oh, we must have him over here. You know, you don't.
No, but
you're a leprechaun,
it's actually,
right?
It's funny you say that because it's a story about the story is I'm my age and I'm a New Yorker guy and I get a call from out of the blue from a long lost relative. There is an Irish side of my family that I've heard about. This is in the movie, but we've never met. And there's been this friction between these two because of three generations ago, two brothers split. One stayed in Europe and ended up in Ireland and the other went to New York and they've never spoken. The fourth generation calls me up and he says, we should bury the axe. I'm like, sure, okay. And I go to Ireland and then it becomes War of the Roses. And like, it's just like, and the sort of the bigger message of the movie is like, how can countries get along? How can people get along? Here's two guys in one family can't even get it together. It shouldn't.
Well, that's the basis of all of it. I mean, you look at the Middle East and you go, wait a second. You guys look like cousins. Do you hate each other? And then you realize
before,
that people were killed.
We were before, but like doing big stuff. I was like, well, this is how I can tackle a big thing in a digestible comedic form. But the heart of it is, Sunnis and Shiites, tell me again the difference exactly.
I know.
Presbyterians, Lutherans, what the difference? Arabs, yeah, Palestinians and Arabs, what's the difference? So now we'll get.
Well, that's our big battle right now that we're all living through. It's like we're all human beings, but people don't want to hear that because there's people going, no, that's not a human being. You know, they're on the other side.
But we will save the world through comedy and dick jokes.
I believe that. And at a certain age, if you look at yourself in the mirror, the dick joke's done for you. Unless you're got, you know, unless The Rock never ages, and maybe he's called that for a reason. We don't know.
Wow. Now you stumbled onto something very deep.
Yeah, I don't want to go near it. I wouldn't. I got to work out. I worked out today. I just did Pilates.
I'm very impressed.
And it's not a machine. It's a woman that comes over.
She's a Greek woman named Pilates.
Exactly. And she just lays on her back and I proform on her.
Really?
I don't know. I have springs. I use springs. Joe Pilates. His name's Joe. Who invented Pilates? Joe Pilates. Hey, Joe Pilates.
I remember doing Pilates years ago. And at the moment I did it, I thought, this is helpful. This feels good. But I just really enjoy sitting. I'm a big fan of sitting.
I like lying down at an angle.
When I can't sit, sometimes I'll lie down.
My bed moves up and down on both sides. My wife and I have separate remotes. We live in a hospital.
Wow.
But you live in a dungeon from Silence of the Lambs.
With your father's pantaloons.
Those are so upsetting.
I'm really embarrassed because I have the same curtains over here, nice and straight.
But those are weird.
That has been up for probably 15 years. Never ever came down until I started Zooming. And now I Zoomed it and saying, you know what? We've been crinkled for 15 years. Fuck you. We're not going to.
You can literally change your career and the future because people are watching you during these Zooms. You're going to be promoting a lot. Well, you got to change that so it looks like an actual curtain. It doesn't look like someone's petticoat.
Well, because, yeah, it's a little ruffled at the bottom. But I think it gives me an everyman appeal. People go, wow.
Yeah, if you lived in the 20s. I mean, every man that lived in the 20s.
Look at this big actor boy. He's got shitty curtains in his house, honey. We're not doing so bad.
See, people, the silkworms that made that, they were held back in school.
Silkworms go to school, Bob.
Wait a minute.
I find a problem with your premise.
You can't buy that bit because you can't buy that premise.
No. Hey, this is great fun. Thank God I begged you to be on this.
I always beg, and I adore you.
I adore you. This is great fun. And now hit record. Let's do one for this show now.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to do that. Oh. I feel bad. So we'll have a
I know we're going to see each other again soon.
And this is coming out on Microfiche. And ViewMaster. But what it's going to happen is I'm going to send this to you and you're going to put it on your virtual things. We can't talk about that show.
No. But you know what? Now that you've made me so self-conscious and ashamed of my curtains, I might not share this. I might actually try to bury this. I'm going to buy this tape back.
I'm going to send you curtains. It's the first time that someone says it's curtains for you, and it's a gift.
You know, when two guys, they say, hey, why don't you guys go pick out the curtains? They don't mean it like that. You actually mean, no, I'm going to pick out curtains.
I already could tell the size of it. I mean, I'd say that's 4 feet tall and 3 feet wide, correct?
I am.
That window. Yeah, you're very small now.
That really does look bad.
How tall does that go up, what I'm looking at? How tall? Is that 4 feet?
No, it's about 6 feet.
Okay, I got to get 6 feet by 4 feet. I'm going on Amazon. It looks like blue would look good. But then it won't match the other ones that are in there that are straight and normal. Can you talk to Paula?
See, those are nice.
Oh, those are nice.
See?
What happened to the schmatas in the back?
They open up like this. That goes like that.
Where'd you get those in Latvia? Were they cheaper?
You know,
I swear it looks like you're running from a pogrom and you're hidden.
Mentally, I am.
Yeah, same here.
All right, my friend.
Be well. Oh, God. Give my love to your wife. She'll know it's from me. Whoops.
All right. I will.
I'll see you soon. Love you, Paul.
See you soon. Be well.
You too. I love Paul Reiser. He's a special guy, self-effacing, right? The drapes, we're going to talk about it. I'm sending him drapes. Anyway, thanks for listening. It was a long one, and I don't get told that ever. But this was talking to an old friend, and he's so passionate about his work. You really want to see this show that's on Peacock right now called There's Johnny. It's got real footage that people have not seen of Johnny Carson. They've seen it, but not for decades. And I just love Paul Reiser. He is he's part of my life. He's part of your life, too, just from having watched Mad About You or all the movies he's been in. And there's a lot coming up because Stranger Things, we can't talk about it. But for God's sakes, I think he becomes Winona Ryder's guy. because her last guy, if you recall, 7 years ago before the pandemic when they were filming. Anyway, this has been Bob Saget's Here For You. That's what this is. And you want to subscribe or follow and rate and review it and say nice stuff because I'm a sensitive man. And, you know, get that. I think I got 4.5 stars. Just get that up to 5 stars. I don't know how you do that. I have stars on here. Does that? No, different word. I'll be funny next time. I didn't have to be. I just wanted to talk to my friend Paul. And if you haven't talked to somebody for a long time, now's a good time to do it because we're still in quarantino. Life is kind of strange. And catching up with him was genuine. And we have been seeing each other with masks. Then we take them off and then we spit food into each other's mouths. So it defeats the purpose. But that's Paul Reiser. And he is an icon and he is a legend and he's still young. I got to convince him of that because that's how I look at things. And I look forward to everything he's got coming up. Love him. And sending love to you guys and your families. And be well. And I will talk to you on the next episode of, you know, BS is Here For You. See, those are bad initials because that's bullshit, but it's not. Not bullshit. Being sincere, doing this because I feel it, right? All right. You take care, everybody. Talk to you later.